Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It's Friday, October 25th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Casual Friday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Daniel Bessner, professor of international relations at the University of Washington, historian. We're talking about Kashmir, what's happening in South Asia, the tension between India and Pakistan, the potentially most dangerous place on earth, and then Daniel's recent Jackman deep dive on the differences in foreign policy between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Then Nomiki Kunst joins us in studio to play sound and laugh and laugh and laugh and heavily criticize Pete Buttigieg, who is the absolute worst. Pete Buttigieg might be called to testify in a trial related to systemic racism and police brutality in his police department in the college town that he runs.
Good.
Very good. Could not come a moment too soon. Buttigieg also wants, well, he wanted, apparently now he's quote-unquote clarifying, more justices like Anthony Kennedy. We'll talk about his actual disastrous Supreme Court plan, even as Bernie Sanders says, I'll go for Sotomayor and Ginsburg. But that's just me. That's just me.
Could have left out Sotomayor.
And could have left out Ginsburg.
That's what I'm saying. Left at
Sotomayor. Yeah. Well, fair enough. But both far better than Kennedy. Oakland school board votes to close schools, drawing protests and vicious police repression. Turkey's Erdogan calls on the U.S. to hand over the Kurdish commander of the democratic forces in northern Syria. The Pentagon is planning to send tanks and armored vehicles to Syria's oil fields. Sometimes you end wars, but then you have to start other wars. Justice Department investigation of Russia probe is criminal in nature. A personal familiar with the probe says White House officials are expected to back up a diplomat's testimony over Trump's push for a Ukraine probe into the Bidens. India is allowing Kashmir to hold local elections even as the lockdown continues. Iraqi police open fire to disperse protesters on Baghdad streets. And now even Hezbollah is getting called to account for neoliberalism and austerity in Lebanon. Chile, unrest continues as the UN human rights chief is dispatched. Protesters stay on the streets again against austerity. House Democrats, along with Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, vote for him, not the Kennedy kid, unveil a bill to protect climate refugees. Very important piece of legislation. A federal judge holds Betsy DeVos in contempt, even as a administrator of the student loan system quits and says basically all of them should be forgiven.
You come at the queen, you best not miss, bitch.
Vote for Bernie Sanders. Full student loan forgiveness. ACLU says 1,500 migrant children were taken from parents by the Trump administration. And the ACLU celebrates a settlement ending an unconstitutional effort to silence pipeline protesters in South Dakota. And Bernie Sanders puts forward a radical marijuana legalization and reparations plan.
At 4:20, no less.
Holla at your boy. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Bernie Sanders is back. fresh off of the mega rally in Queens with AOC. Here he is on Jimmy Kimmel explaining why we need to have full health care for everybody, period.
You speak very honestly about on these subjects. I think you are very blunt and brutally honest, almost to the point where it's shocking to see a politician say, yes, this is going to make your taxes go up. But in the big picture, I think that it will make it cost you less.
Right. Look, here is the reality. We are the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people as a human right. I believe that health care is a human right and not a privilege. And what that means is we need all that we need to do. People make this more complicated than it is. Medicare right now is the most popular health insurance program in America. I want to expand Medicare to include dental care, hearing aids, and eyeglasses. And then what I want to do is lower the eligibility age first year from 65 down to 55, then to 45, then to 35, and then we cover everybody. And when we do that, there are no more premiums. You're not paying any more premiums, no more co-payments, no more deductibles, no more out-of-pocket expenses. And virtually every person in this country will save money on health care because we are currently spending twice as much per person as the people of any other major country. And the reason for that is that the function of the healthcare system today, shock of all shocks, is to make the drug companies and the insurance companies incredibly rich. Well, I don't think that's the function of healthcare. So if you are paying, just as an example, if somebody who is self-employed today is paying $15,000, $20,000 a year in premiums and out-of-pocket expenses, that's all gone. Well, they may pay $7,000 or $8,000 more in taxes. They're $12,000 to the good. And that's what we have got to do. We have to do what every other country does, is make sure that anybody can go to any doctor they want, whenever they want, and not worry about the cost of health care.
Perfectly put. This is something that he's been fighting for with clarity and consistency for 40 years. He's absolutely right. And I just want to say, I mean, notice the difference here. I sympathize with Warren's resistance of the tax framing question because it's a fundamentally right-wing way of asking the question. However, and of course, it's still unclear what her actual healthcare plan is. I've actually even heard that it might involve a VAT, which is extremely regressive if that turns out to be the case.
She's talked so many circles around it that it's really concerning to me.
I mean, yes, and there's some sound that we'll get to in the latter part of the show. I'm not clear where she is on this issue. I'm sure she'll put forward something that's better than the status quo. Biden has put forward something that's better than the status quo. But I want to just say that getting tripped up, the refusal and the transparent concern about, oh, well, if I say there will be middle class tax cuts, it will be clipped, a tax increase, it will be clipped in an ad and played in November. That's true. But you get caught in playing these word games and going around in circles about that one specific word, even as, again, I sympathize with her resistance to it. But Bernie right there, it's clean. Yes, you might pay $7,000 more in taxes. You'll save several, you know, at least maybe even more, you know, several thousand in private health insurance costs. Boom, done, simple, it. So you make the same point, you bring the same clarity, but you also, you know, you don't invite the look of being a sort of prevaricating politician. And I think, you know, again, this is one of those issues. You can go back literally to the 1970s. He was making exactly the same point. He was right then. He's right now. He's absolutely right about the implementation. I remember when Sanders' bill got unveiled and the Jaipal bill got unveiled in the House. Even the sort of Voxes of the world at the time were like, okay, this is how you do it. These are real policy proposals. They're not that difficult to implement at all. And there's a clear timeline. And again, it covers absolutely every single person, fully, including mental health, dental health, and eye care. That's what we need.
Yep. And when you get out in front of the question like that, little twerps like Mayor Pete can't make an issue out of it. Like, no, you're not being honest about the costs. Like, yes, you are.
Right. Exactly. And then we can go to a dishonest little twerp like Mayor Pete and we can say how Medicare for all who want it is a public option, which you're not being clear about how it's going to compete, how it's going to work with the broader regulatory environment for insurance companies. It's still going to leave millions of people vulnerable and overcharged. It almost certainly will continue, a rate of people dying premature deaths. After several year decline, it looks like uninsured rates are starting to move back up a bit. So you have to explain to us, Mayor Pete, why you still want to leave millions of people vulnerable and underinsured, and also why, you know, you talk about being young and thinking about different things. I mean, Mayor Pete is giving us the progressive option of 2007. How about we go with the progressive option of 2019 that someone like Bernie Sanders has been right about and clear about for 40 years? Folks, there's no other way of saying it. Well, let me see. Actually, all right. Yeah, no, I think we should probably do. Yeah, we should just do ads. Yeah. Support for today's show is brought to you by Third Love. With more than 80 sizes, including their signature half cup sizes, Third Love designs bras with breast size and shape in mind for a perfect fit and premium feel. We have a testimonial that will really show you how great Third Love is. I like that they don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two and both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for everyday bra, but not as boring as most t-shirts bras. Subtle, cute details, so I don't feel basic. This is hands down the most comfortable bra you'll own, with straps that won't slip and tagless labels. I can't speak to the bra part, but I hate the tagless label.
Yeah, tagless is good.
Incredibly good design
feature. I can
co-sign
the concept of taglessness.
Taglessness is another testament to the superior design quality of Third Love. Not to mention lightweight, super thin memory foam cups that mold to your shape. Best of all, every customer has 60 days to wear it, wash it, and put it to the test. If you don't love it, you can return it, and Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering our listeners 15% off of your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off of your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. Today's show is also brought to you by Blinkist. If you feel like you don't have enough time to read all the books on your list, you're not alone. Blinkist is an app that compiles key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know is condensed down into 15 minutes, and you can read or listen to it with the app. Blinkist is really unique, and it works on your phone, tablet, or web browser. You'll find everything from health and self-help to history and business books included in Blinkist libraries. I am totally following Sam's lead on this, and I am reading business and optimization and self-help books by any number of authors, including the 4-Hour Workweek. I checked out the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And then, actually, we'll get to them later, but even something that, I'm not going to read all of it, but it's in the zeitgeist. Michelle Obama's new book is an example. It's extremely convenient and great to use. And, there's just literally only so many hours in the day, and there's total information overload. So this gives you the condensed guide you need. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want for all one low price. Right now, for limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for our listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority to try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off of your new subscription. That's Blinkist.com /majority to start your free 7-day trial and save 25% off and get titles like The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss, Becoming by Michelle Obama, Getting Things Done by David Allen, The Power of Habits, and Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman, one of my faves. All right, everybody, we're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with Daniel Bessner.
Why are the coppers up in the choppers? Oh, flying over my head, 26, 49, 58 day.
Welcome back to The Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Daniel Bessner. He's author of a fantastic book, which I recommend everybody order and read to help you understand the world we're in, Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier, and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual. Now, that sounds like a heavy lift, and it is in the sense that you'll learn a lot, but it's an incredibly readable and engaging book, which is not necessarily something you would expect from the Pyle Professor of American International of History. Oh my God, I'm going to mess it up, Daniel. The Pyle Professor of American American Foreign Policy at the Scoop Jackson School at the University of Washington, and also, I guess you would expect it on this end, a regular contributor and on TMBS. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Let's talk about Kashmir a bit. Always apologies if I'm mispronouncing that. We know that a couple of months ago now, the Indian BJP government tore up the Indian constitution and implemented a crackdown and news blackout with reports of numerous vicious human rights violations in Kashmir. We also know that this actually also correlates within, I believe it's Assam, which is another region in India, with a demand that Muslim people establish proof of citizenship and residency in India, that this all fits into this bigger extreme right Hindutva agenda as represented by Narendra Modi and the BJP. And also, though, that this story goes back to the founding of the modern state of India, and that Kashmir is already one of the most, if not the most militarized region on earth. There's also a geopolitical component with Pakistan, and that's heated up the last week with fire being exchanged between Indian and Pakistani forces. Can you kind of give us a big picture rundown of the different dynamics at play and what might be the most dangerous part of the world right now?
Sure. So the first thing to probably recognize is that when people talk about modern nuclear exchanges in the literature on nuclear exchange, they generally refer to the most likely place for such an exchange to be in South Asia, in the Indian subcontinent, and particularly between Pakistan and India. And so most of the models done on what would be in, the effect of a nuclear exchange have been done on basically the exchange of about 100 Hiroshima-level bombs. And according to the most recent analyses, as far as I'm aware, were, you know, relatively weak nuclear bombs in terms of 219 exchanged in such a way there'd be probably a global famine. So one of the most important things to recognize and why people listening to this and Americans in general should be concerned with what's going on is because it has a profound potential to totally affect geopolitics. So it's a really important issue, the relationship between India and Pakistan. So that's just the first thing to highlight when you're talking about this region generally. But in terms of taking maybe a bit of a more medium historical view, is that I think it's important to think of what's going on now as a process of state formation and state consolidation. Mm-hmm. So basically, if you think about the fact that India and Pakistan were founded in 1947, you know, at the outcome of a century or so, century plus of British colonialism, you can see that these are relatively new states, some of the first post-colonial states in the world. And what you see here going on is that what Modi, as I think, is trying to do is trying to bring a region that has long been an excuse to arm the Indian military and to basically keep on going with the war against Pakistan under firm control of the Indian state. So one way to think of this is that this is the end of a long process of state consolidation that is actually rather common when you think about state formation. For example, think about, let's say, the first 80 years of the United States, 1776 to roughly the Civil War. So these are a period of state formation. So I think it's important to think of it in terms of that and what's going on here. Secondly, what you have here is the creation of this sort of national mythos ideology organized around Hindutva, as you just mentioned. So it's also crucial to Modi to justify what he's doing by consolidating the Kashmiri, essentially consolidating his control of Kashmir. And this is something that's not only going on in India, but also going on in Pakistan with the relatively new prime minister, Imran Khan, a cricket hero of the 1990s, in the last year or two, basically also consolidating control of the so-called Kurram agencies, right? What had been semi-autonomous regions are now being put under increasing control of the centralized Pakistani state. So on both sides of the India-Pakistan divide, what you see is this process of state consolidation within this larger process of sort of geopolitical enmity that has existed between the two states from the beginning. And that is important because even though, you know, we all theoretically want world peace, the sort of enmity between the two countries has been a justifying logic for the militaries of both countries in order to increase their own power and their own hold over the basic governance structures of both of these. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens going forward, particularly as we enter really a new era of really post-Cold War geopolitics, seeing the emergence of not only these new right-wing authoritarian governments, but also new forms of alliances that would have been impossible during the era of the Cold War. The one that really leaps out at me is the one between the pseudo one, at least, between Israel and Saudi Arabia, right? These previously unthinkable alliances are now, as the logic of the Cold War recedes, as people come to power who weren't totally formed by the Cold War, these sorts of new logics of geopolitics are coming into play. And I think you're seeing that right now with what's going on between India and Pakistan. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the future.
And it seems to me, I mean, let's actually go to Pakistan in a minute, but in India too, that when you talk about this state formation, it's a specific shot at the narrow consensus, right? So, you know, it's always dangerous because you're skipping a lot of history. And of course, you know, even after the founding, I mean, the founding of independent India and then partition with Pakistan led to millions of people's deaths Then you have a history that includes Indira Gandhi declaring martial law, sterilizing poor and lower caste people in the 1980s after she's assassinated because of her rights violations of the Sikh community. She's literally assassinated by her own bodyguards who are Sikh. The Indian Congress Party looks the other way while there are days of pogroms that are, you know, just mass murder of Sikhs. And then there's this other thread line of BJP, RSS, and Hindu nationalism going back to like the 20s. The person, you know, Gandhi's assassin is at the very least connected to this politics. But that being said, you did have at least some other countervailing tendencies in India of a certain commitment of an incredibly progressive constitution written by the, Dalit untouchable Ambedkar, who converted to Buddhism and rejected the caste system and was a Marxist. Nehru, who did have some clear commitments to open society. So that when Modi is doing this, it's also, when you talk about that state consolidation, it is a violent rejection of what had been a certain like founding consensus of the people that had liberated India.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I think you also have to understand, at least from my colleagues who study this, I'm basically repeating what they said, Sunila Kale and Radhika Govindrajan, two great scholars at the University of Washington. My sense of talking to them is that some of the proto-BJP had also been victims of the sort of 70s martial law, and the 70s emergency law. So this is, in a sense, a direct reaction to what you were just speaking about, that these are the dialectic, essentially, of Indian politics seems to be operating in a serious way right now. And of course, it's important to recognize that India is an enormous country, an enormously complex country with different regional traditions and different regional governments. And so it's in some sense difficult to think to speak totally coherently of a unitary Indian state in the way that one might speak about it in other areas of the world. But I do think that what we're seeing here is the attempt to centralize that type of power, but particularly from the geopolitical perspective. What's interesting to see is what this is going to mean, particularly for Indian-China relations, right? You already see Pakistan has long been associating with China, and as the United States probably begins to retreat from the region, and who knows, we might be in Afghanistan for another 50 years, but my guess is in the next 5-10 years, the United States will maintain some sort of rump force, but will no longer be as much of a power player in a region, particularly as it's been the last 20 years. The geopolitical constellation is totally changing in South Asia, particularly as China continues its quote-unquote rise. So you're going to, it'll be interesting to see how India tries to balance against China as it begins to assert itself more and more in the subcontinent itself and in East Asia and Southeast Asia in particular. So you basically have, what's most interesting to me as a scholar of international relations, is the emergence of a new post-Cold War order. We don't quite have a name for it, but basically the geopolitical order that existed for the last 30 years and when the United States was the unquestioned hegemon is going to be something different going forward. What that is, I don't think anyone on the ground knows, but I think you're seeing its early formation right now. And again, you see it with this sort of consolidation of the hold over Kashmir, or this consolidation over the Kurram agencies in both India and Pakistan in the subcontinent. You see a somewhat coming to an end, perhaps, I mean, only time will tell, but a coming to the end of that early period of state formation. You know, the first 80-100 years of states are generally very violent and very destructive. You know, ours ended with a civil war and, you know, the continued violence of Jim Crow and things along those lines. I don't want to mitigate that. But also you're seeing, you know, the end of what might be considered to be the first stage of state consolidation and state formation going forward in the post-colonial world.
In Pakistan, though, I mean, I'm wondering in the Pakistani case, because there's conflicting reports on what Imran Khan represents, right? And again, yeah. This is also an incredible simplification, but just to try to get a little bit of grounding in Pakistan, I mean, you have a state that's founded by actually, you know, certainly a Muslim and a very kind of, you know, I guess you would say in the parlance of today, a very moderate liberal Muslim whose argument for founding Pakistan is, well, if you watch the Attenborough movie, it's really about his own personal ambition. Others would say that, you know, it's actually just a deep concern about basically the civil rights position of Muslims in an independent India. So you have these conflicting tendencies, and it seems like in India, Pakistan, as we talk about today, going back to the 80s, is one big thing that happened is that under General Zia-ul-Haq, who took power in a coup that got rid of Bhutto, who was a someone that I think we could really easily problematize in terms of his record, but was certainly had some socialist tendency and rhetoric, a huge amount of charisma. There's a story of Bhutto that was I loved, especially just because of the flip he did, where in a meeting apparently with JFK, Kennedy said, you know, Mr. Bhutto, if you were in the United States, I'd have you in my cabinet. And Bhutto looked at him and he said, if I was in the United States, you'd be in my cabinet, which I always I always like that sort of flip. But you have the Bhutto family, and then you have the Zarif family, and there's a lot more history to get into, but let's just say that they represent different political parties slash kind of patronage network dynastic politics. And I think people are probably certainly familiar with someone like Benazir Bhutto, she extraordinary amount of charisma and physical courage, who was assassinated. And then there's the military formally being in control of Pakistan, as is the case with Musharraf, and then this sort of, you know, say really a deep state would be the word, right? Particularly led by the inter-services intelligence, which is always, at the very least, I mean, is dominating Pakistani foreign policy, particularly with regards to Afghanistan, India, Saudi, and the United States. As well as China, obviously. But anywhere that there's some type of guerrilla operations or counterinsurgency, they're at the center of it. So, and then cutting across all of these is different conflicts about the idea of what Islam is. So it's just very complicated. And when you talk about consolidating, I mean, is Imran Khan a consolidator, or is he... the population is so disgusted and burned out by the old politics and the relentless, you know, the corruption, the austerity, the neoliberalism, the feudalism. I mean, really everything that's bad is fused, right, in these different Pakistani tendencies. He's charismatic. He represents something new. But is he really just the new, you know, charismatic vehicle of the same military intelligence apparatus interests?
Well, I think from my understanding is it's believed to be that he's associated with the military. So in some sense, he does represent those interests. And I think it's right. But I do think the charisma and the quote unquote populist energy that he brings does have the potential to do something new for the country of Pakistan, especially considering its new geopolitical position vis-a-vis India and vis-a-vis China. So I think that is what he's really trying to do, is trying to situate the Pakistan in a truly post-American South Asia. What that looks like is going to be difficult to know, because I think it depends a lot on essentially the developing Chinese-Pakistani relationship and what that trade relationship looks like and what that military exchange relationship looks like. But essentially, he has to balance, as I see it, he feels that he has to balance against India in a meaningful way, particularly as Modi takes increasingly horrible anti-Muslim actions within India itself. You know, the rejection of particularly the Muslim cultural elite, you know, that goes back to the Mughal Empire, you know, and this, you know, the embrace of Hindutva and everything related to that. So I think he's in a relatively difficult position. And I think everything that you're saying also highlights the difficulties in general, as a general intellectual problem of applying, Western intellectual models of a nation state and imposing them on territories. First, the formal imposition of these, of this particular model of state formation, that is the nation state, on the post-colonial world, which happened for a variety of reasons. But in terms of analyzing it, there are so many different divisions within these societies, and the state is weak in some areas and very strong in other areas, that it's difficult, again, to think about how to speak of these societies, or rather these nation states, as unitary actors. Because as you suggested, with the various interests going on here, it's difficult to actually know what's really going on. But I do think there is an attempt, at least from what I can tell, to try to consolidate the state's control over areas where it had formally ceded some form of organization and control, particularly in the formerly semi or autonomous areas of the Kerm agencies. But to me, what'll be most interesting, again, from an IR perspective, which is really, I'm not an expert by any means on Pakistani or Indian domestic politics, but from an IR perspective, what do these countries do as the United States in particular begins to recede from the region, in this new post-Cold War logic? And I think the next few years are going to be crucial to figuring out what exactly that looks like, particularly as both India and Pakistan react to China. And then this leads to the question of what is China going to do in the region? The United States has long asserted control over its entire hemisphere, particularly in Latin America, and that goes back hundreds of years at this point. Is China going to try to attempt to do something similar in the region, or is it going to continue to just balance against India, make inroads with Pakistan, try to dominate basically Korea and Japan and Indonesia in some sense through economic means and trade means, or is it going to try to do something more aggressive? I don't think it will, but that's really an open question. We haven't seen extremely powerful China in the modern era yet.
Daniel Bessner, you have a new piece in The Jacobin where you outline the real profound differences between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on foreign policy, which very much relate to not only our, aspirations as people with a socialistic viewpoint and a desire for greater solidarity and a post-hegemonic world of all kinds, whether the United States or China, but also with real practical ramifications in terms of, handling these potentially very explosive situations in a way that's, I'll actually say, like prudent and safe. Spell out the differences for us.
Sure. So I think what's important to emphasize at first is that when it comes to declared policies, there's actually like a bunch of similarities between Bernie and Warren. No, they both say they want to end endless war. They both say they want to reduce the influence of the military-industrial complex on foreign policymaking. They both say they want to develop trade policies that benefit labor at the expense of capital. So I think this is what has led a bunch of people who are only, understandably casually watching this competition to basically say that there's no difference between them. And if there's no difference between them, we should vote for the female candidate. And I appreciate that if there were truly no difference between them. But the problem is that when you actually dig into what they say, and I put on my intellectual historian hat here, when you read what they say, when you read their texts, when you read what they their vision of foreign policy that they express, they actually have rather radically different understandings of what the United States' role in the world is. And not to put too fine a point on it, but in brief, I think it's fair to describe Warren as a rather traditional American nationalist, one might even say American exceptionalist. At some point in one of her foreign policy speeches, she says something along the lines of she will be dedicated to defending America's interests first and foremost in the world. And Bernie, I think, really taps into a much older tradition of social democratic internationalism, or democratic socialist internationalism, however you want to put it, that goes back, roughly a century plus in the United States. So where Warren, in all of her foreign policies, essentially says repeatedly, I'm here to defend American workers. I'm here to defend American interests. I'm here to defend American labor and American business. Of course, she also says that, which is, as far as I know, something that Bernie has never said. Bernie very much talks in an internationalist key. So he very much says that his interest is not to only defend American workers, but to basically end what he calls the race to the bottom, what his campaign calls the race to the bottom in the international economy, where American workers have to compete with Vietnamese workers or Malaysian workers who are making very little money with very few benefits. So what he wants to do, he's speaking in a really internationalist way, which I think is crucial, considering that we still live in the era of incredible global interconnection. Of globalization, if that's what you want to refer to it as. And it's not really possible, at least if you're a progressive and you take as your foundational philosophical position that all human lives are equal, to think in the explicitly nationalist terms that Warren does. That if you truly adopt a left-wing politics, which to me the foundational position is that all people, again, are equal, you need to think in an internationalist way that takes the lives of people abroad as seriously as you take the lives of Americans. And I think you actually saw this in the most recent rally when Bernie said, you know, look to your side. Are you willing to fight for someone who you don't know, who's not you? And that is the argument of his foreign policy. The argument of his foreign policy is that we need an international progressive movement in order to basically solve the challenges of the day. And Bernie identifies the major challenges of the day as being global. He repeatedly talks about climate change and global inequality. And these, he is right to say, are only going to be solved through international coalition building and what he calls a global progressive movement. Whereas Warren, as far as I can tell, is still thinking in the traditional sort of nation state centered way of the Cold War and post-Cold War eras. And I think this is probably due to the fact that foreign policy isn't a major interest of hers. It never was. In fact, I would characterize Warren as being very similar ideologically to a 1950s era Eisenhower Republican, like a liberal Republican. As someone who studies that era, that is what her policies read like most to me. You know, she thinks capitalism is good, but some bad capitalist has done some bad things. She thinks the United States should sometimes go to war, but we've gone to too many wars because some corrupt people have done some corrupt things. While Bernie adopts a fundamentally different understanding of both foreign policy and the United States' role in the world.
Let's really spell out. I mean, first of all, in fact, it is a leadership role, and the framing of it has major implications. So actually building a frame around solidarity versus sort of a national self-interest argument. I mean, as one example, and Ryan Grimm actually brought this to my attention. Ryan Grimm is certainly, you know, certainly more pro-Warren than me. So it was interesting getting it from him. But even when Warren has spoken very little on civilian casualties. Now, all of them speak very little on civilian casualties. But, you know, Bernie at times has certainly talked about the toll of U.S. just abuses and civilian casualties abroad. When Warren has, and it's extremely infrequently, she'll always frame it in terms of the bad public relations perception for the United States that is created by, as an example, all of the people the U.S. military is killing in Afghanistan. So as this gets practical, and you also point to in your piece, I mean, one, we know that right out of the gate, this is the one area, you know, there's all these arguments about theories of change, whether or not we should have a more ambitious or more limited agenda on, you know, major areas of domestic policy. But what we all know is that when you walk into the White House, and this is actually another piece of your work, this is a big problem structurally. But as it stands now, the president has a vast bureaucracy and a huge amount of power over foreign policy, which, you know, if anything is not mitigated by Congress, it's probably mitigated and mediated by the military and intelligence apparatus, which is, you know, obviously profoundly dangerous and undemocratic. But so these perceptions and how they look at the world matter hugely. And I think to drill into it specifically, let's talk about climate change and how it does relate to at least the notion that we need some type of transnational coordination to tackle a common problem versus this notion that, you know, and again, this is in the context of Warren voting for Trump military budget increases and Sanders voting against them, that we can kind of like green upgrade the military. And I, And just as I ask this, there's a, you know, the kind of moral objection, sure, but there's also sort of like a, you know, how green can Walmart ever be component to this, right? Like, yes, you can, and sure, you could, you know, let's have tanks that run on hydrogen, fine. But at the end of the day, having a vast global killing state is going to eat up a infinite amount of human resources, even if you make it slightly more energy efficient, which, by the way, the Pentagon has actually been working on doing for quite some time. The Pentagon is, you know, better on these issues than other parts of the federal bureaucracy. But get into the drill down of not just the philosophical difference, but the enormous practical implications of we need to sit down with fellow stakeholders to deal with the climate crisis versus let's have solar powered hovercrafts.
Yeah, I think that's very big. And an important thing to emphasize is that if the United States is focusing on its, you know, $700+ billion military budget, they're not focusing on other things. So an important thing to emphasize is that when you have this global military state, it actually takes not only resources, but energy away from doing things like solving climate change. And you're never going to solve climate change through a green military for a variety of reasons. One, that isn't going to really stop anything. But two, and probably most importantly, it's going to signal to the rest of the world that the United States isn't serious about transnational organization or international negotiations. So I think what is difficult for us to appreciate from the United States is how much the rest of the world distrusts us for a variety of reasons, because of basically everything we did during the Cold War and everything we did after the Cold War, where it was made clear that what U.S. leadership meant was not that we were going to, you know, interact with other nations and try to guide them in a quote unquote positive direction, but that we were going to tell other nations what to do. So there's an enormous lack of trust in the United States that maintaining a global military state is never, it's just, you're never going to overcome it if you maintain the 800 bases, I don't care how clean energy and efficient they are. So that is probably the most important way in which Warren, basically, as far as I can tell, status quo vision is going to prevent solving these international problems. The first step in solving climate change is reducing America's military bases by showing the rest of the world that the United States is going to take them seriously as relatively equal negotiating partners, particularly China and particularly India, which, as everyone knows, are two of the largest global emitters in the world. I think the top three are India, China, and the U.S. Apologies if I get that wrong, but I'm pretty sure that they're in the top five, definitely. So we're going to need to negotiate with these countries, and we're going to need to negotiate from an area of good faith. And this is why I think it's actually very critical who is president, because as you suggested at the beginning of your comment and question, is that the president basically is literally a king. And in all of the areas of the federal bureaucracy and federal state-making capacity, foreign policy is probably the area in which the president has the most discretion for a variety of reasons. In the last 70 or so years, foreign policy authority, it has increasingly centralized not only around the president, but in the White House itself. The National Security Council is an incredibly influential body of foreign policy making, as we've talked about before on your podcast. And so this is the area, probably more so than any other area, unless the president pursues a policy of executive orders, which has, you know, its benefits and drawbacks, and we could talk about that, that Bernie or Warren is going to be able to make an enormous difference. And I think that's important to recognize, because Bernie clearly has long-standing, decades-long anti-imperialist credentials in a way that Warren just does not. I don't mean to keep on, you know, trashing her, but I just don't think that she cares much about foreign policy, and I don't think she's really thought about it that much. It's never been part of her political vision or her political perspective. So I think it's actually really important to look beyond just the pure policies that both recommend, and to really think, like, what is their vision of the United States' role in the world? That is to say, that is not to say that if Warren gets into office, I don't think I don't think things would be totally the same. I imagine that she would probably stop intervening as much. I imagine that she would try to negotiate trade agreements that actually benefit labor over capital. Mm-hmm. But I also imagine that she really wouldn't get rid of any of the bases. So I think that she would keep the structure. My guess is that Warren would keep the structure of American foreign policy relatively intact while making changes in the superstructure of the policies, whereas Bernie at least could begin a process of changing that structure. And I want to emphasize that this is probably a decades long process. You know, what I always say is Rome wasn't built in a day, right? But it also wasn't taken apart in a day. And so I think what you need to do is you need to elect someone like Bernie to at least begin the fundamental structural transformation that is necessary, not only that we, you know, keep on diverting resources from welfare to weapons, but that we're able to negotiate with international partners in a meaningful way to basically take on these problems of the global commons, climate change, and global inequality.
Yeah, and as a final question, I mean, as part of that project that Sanders is bringing to the table, there's, you know, people like Matt Duss as an example, and I would say, you know, in the broader intellectual sense, like Adoma Kechiachu and you, who are taking the next phase of a left-wing critique. And this is another reason why it's really important that people order Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier, and The Rise of the Defense Intellectuals, because you're actually working programmatically. And I think that, you know, that's another thing that's happening around Bernie as well, which is that if there isn't an active effort to at least start to rethink these things, then you just revert to bureaucratic type. And that's the same people who've implemented these disasters of the last several decades. So I just, before you go, could you just touch on that?
Sure. So basically, what I think my book actually relates directly to this, because the reason that I studied a guy like Hans Speier, who is one of the architects of the national security state in the mid-20th century, is that I wanted to see what were the ideas and assumptions that actually animated the structure that we have now. Because the structure that we have now was essentially created during World War II. And it's when you get, you know, the first permanent propaganda agencies, you get the first permanent intelligence, really professionalized intelligence apparatus. And after World War II, the National Security Act of 1947, you get the precursor to the Department of Defense, you get the formal creation of the CIA, and you get the creation of the National Security Council. So what I wanted to do by studying Speier was to figure out why someone who actually started his life as a socialist thought that the creation of these institutions was necessary to world peace. And it essentially had to do with his particular vision of geopolitics that emerged from his experiences first with fascism and then with basically Stalinism during and after World War II. And when you actually look at the founding moment of these institutions I want to add that continue to define what American foreign policy is, you see that almost all of the assumptions that the people who made these institutions, who built them, had no longer hold. Right. The United States is the overwhelming military power in the world. It really faces no real threat, despite what the foreign policy establishment would have you believe. And in fact, we've gone to such an absurd degree that we have roughly 800 bases compared to, depending on who you ask, the 20 or so Russia has, or the 1 to 9 that China has. So this is ridiculous. The imperial order that the United States has created today is ridiculous. And the assumptions that made that order created, that made sure that order was created in the first place, no longer hold. And I saw that by examining this whole Hans Speier thing, and I relate it to today in my book. So I think that's what's really critical, is that what we really need as an organized left is to begin a project of not only ideological transformation and, you know, seizing of the means of production, as crucial as that might be, but also thinking in an imperial way in terms of the imperial structure, not thinking in imperial way, thinking in terms of the imperial structures that we have, and thinking about how to transform those structures programmatically, to have a project of institutional reform. So let's say, you know, we're not going to have it if Bernie wins and he enters in 2020, but let's say in 10 years, by in the next 4 to 8 to 12 years, that the left wing actually has a project of institutional reform to say, no, we actually should abolish the CIA and replace it with this, or not even replace it with this, and just say we don't want a global intelligence apparatus, at least organized in the way that it was. Abolish the NSC because it's too anti-democratic, and abolish the DOD because it actually makes the military too much of a foreign policymaker. So we need to be thinking in these structural terms, and this is what I tried to get at in my book, and I think this is the crucial project going forward. And we're really at the beginning of it. We're really in an inchoate stage of it, but I think you're going to see it happen more and more going forward as the social democratic left continues to assert itself in American politics.
And I just want to add too, I mean, this is also the answer to people who, you know, will slide into my timeline with sometimes legitimate and sometimes just whiny and pedantic, like, but what about Bernie? He, you know, he was bad on such and such. And, you know, the answer to that is, well, you know, in some cases, like with Libya, yeah, he was. And the second and bigger and more relevant point is we're in a context now where, first of all, unlike any other candidate, he can revert to type, which goes back to fighting Reagan's dirty wars in Central America in the 1980s when, you know, he's the mayor. You know, this is totally unparalleled. And also that because we do think structurally and we do understand the movement and the structure of a campaign, that this is the opportunity to start taking those baby steps. And of course, there's a huge amount to do. And of course, there's way more that needs to be put on the table. But do you actually start that movement or not? And that's really the very basic and very fundamental question.
Yeah, and I would just add, my guess is that that movement wouldn't even begin to get going with Warren.
Of course.
I don't think she cares about it. I do not think she'd expend political capital on challenging the military, which is what you're going to need to do. You're right. Going to need to challenge the top brass of the military, and you're going to need to expend a fair bit of political capital, and I don't think she has the interest or concern with that. I just don't. I don't see it.
Solidarity. Not solar drones. The book is Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual, the United States and the World. Honestly, I can't emphasize not only, first of all, this is a book that I read cover to cover, which is increasingly difficult in today's world. And this is a fantastically fun book to read because Daniel Bessner is actually a very, very good writer in addition to being a shaper of young minds at the Pyle School, at the Scoop Jackson School at the University of Washington. I always love that you teach there. I find that hilarious. And you can hear him regularly, including our illicit history two-parter of the Rand Corporation and the defense apparatus for TMBS. Daniel, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael. Talk to you later, man.
Thanks, man. Take care.
Bye.
Guys, really do. Matt, have you read that book?
No, it's on my list.
Okay, because it's not on... it's not an audio form.
I think it is on audio form.
Really?
Actually, maybe.
I thought
you
actually already read it. I really would order that book. Let's put a link of it in the show notes. I was going to say the first step
in
8 years we can have the Constitution amended so Ilhan Omar can run for president. No Miki's here.
Is this,
she's arrived.
On camera now? Is it?
Is she on camera?
I escaped the MTA hellhole that I feel like it just gets exponentially worse.
Why? You're a New York political pro.
It's not hard. It's hashtag Cuomo's MTA. I feel like we need to revive that a little bit.
I'm with it.
The MTA board chair was out. It's kind of back in now. There's a lot of controversy. He's supposed to be the guru who fixed the MTA or the other subway systems around the world. But he can't fix this one because, I don't know, maybe he doesn't have any money to fix it because we won't tax the mother effing billionaires of this city.
There we go.
It's really pretty simple, right? Really.
It's really simple.
Don't let anybody complicate what's simple. I'm so sick of it. I'm so sick.
How are we going to pay for it?
No, it's not.
Tax the freebies.
You could literally just, there's especially if you're actually in New York.
Right.
Just go on that very same subway, wait for your transfer for 30 minutes. And
maybe.
Then go for there's a several block radius on the Upper East Side. Then, or you can go to Tribeca. You could literally go physically where the money is.
Right.
That we just need to take back to put into this.
That's it.
Well,
we should have an Occupy MTA. Wait, are we starting a movement right now?
I think we might be
there
doing
we go.
It. I'm not opposed to it.
There have been whispers about how we need a new militant and radical transit riders union in this town. Yes, so
most
maybe
did
that's
you
the
see what they did in Santiago? Did you guys catch that?
Oh, yes. The ride. Yes.
When the way they occupied the station and then waved people in for free.
Yeah.
That is called a fair strike.
Awesome.
It has a very long history.
There you go.
And also check out Matt and I's TMBS video reviewing people's subway hopping techniques. Remember that?
I have to find this. So
there was some local, actually it was really disgusting. This local news, I don't remember which one in New York, they went out and they found people hopping turnstiles to shame them.
No.
Oh, yeah, that was disgusting.
Oh, it was so disgusting. And what was actually – and it was fun because, you know, it was like some people, it was depressing. Like they hid their faces and it was disgusting. But it's also New York, so you had a lot of like who the fuck are you?
Right. Good.
Who are you? Are you a cop? Who are you? I don't know you. Blah, blah, blah. And so, what they unintentionally did was they showed all of the security footage of different people like jumping. Like basically what we did on TMBS was we reviewed technique. We were like, okay, we got the duck method, got the straight up jump. I will say that whenever I may or may not have done that, I was a jumper.
You're a jumper? Definitely. I do the door.
Yeah, I prefer to do the door.
The door barely even counts.
It's like a nice passive way to evade the fare. They can still get you a ticket.
I got one.
I fought my way out of it, and I was like, you know, first off, they're expanding this now. They have the money to buy effing ads on the subway being like,
By the way, thank you. Very professional. I use the full F word.
I don't know if I'm allowed
No, we're not supposed to.
Okay.
And this is the second time that you have.
It's very hard.
Very well done.
I have to put on my TV persona.
I don't think I've ever properly
sworn on television except for C-SPAN accidentally, and that went a little bit viral.
I remember that meltdown moment.
Yeah.
Oh, but that was great.
I thought
you cursed at that Brian Lamb guy. That would have been funny. What's his name? There's something like,
yeah, it's Brian
one of those
Lamb,
like, I'm sure he's a nice guy, but one of those like random, like my comedic vision was that you were on one of those like, good morning, welcome to C-SPAN. Now Mickey Cons is with us. You're calling on the Democrat line from Cleveland City. And then now Mickey's like, what the fuck? And then they're just like, whoa. I think what I love is that even if you did curse one of those guys out, they'd still be like, well, all right, quite spirited. Let's get back to the phone lines.
That's poker face. Play poker with that man. Yeah.
No, yeah. Absolutely.
Brian Lamb would be the worst person to play poker with.
Brian Lamb probably has like 50 mil stashed from poker winnings. Probably just like, you're like, I know you're bluffing.
The most inscrutable host of all
time. Am I?
Has he ever broken his face?
Like, I have never. I've never seen him break his face. I literally used to, and extremely immature of me, I used to watch montages of people prank calling C-SPAN.
Why is that immature? I thought you were prank calling.
Well, no comment. But I used to watch montages of people prank calling C-SPAN. And like, he just never, he would just be like, seems like a prank call. It's like zero satisfaction.
He's like, is this really Barack Obama?
No,
okay, Michael.
Yeah, right. He's just like, there's Michael Brooks with the black nationalist Obama impression. Oh, okay. You go back to the lines. You're calling from New Jersey on the independent line. Fluoride's killing all of us, Brian. All right. What do you think about that? Is fluoride killing all of us? Next. That guy actually is super admirable. I didn't realize how cool he was until we started breaking that down.
Should invite him on as a guest.
It's like, what do you think about that,
There's
Brian?
No chance he would do
that. Like, yeah, that would be great.
He's like, if I could stay
for the post game and do a bad segment.
If I get anywhere near an opinion, I burst into flames.
I'd be like, all we're asking, no political opinions, just teach us how to have a straight face when we're doing call-ins.
Right.
Be like, I lose my temper. I snap at people when they call in. You know, maybe not you. I didn't. When I had a serious show, I never.
No, definitely him.
Yeah, definitely Michael.
I snap it. Oh, whatever. Snap at people. I don't know if I snap at people. I think I maybe don't have an unending, infinite supply of patience.
Yeah,
that's how I'd put it too.
You know what I watched? I was watching because I was watching a Zizek clip recently, and it was great. From this old Vice profile, and he was like, what I like to do is I like to start like a debate 5 minutes early, and so that even if someone comes on time or they're only 2 minutes late, they feel a little bit guilty. And the guy's like, why do you want people to feel guilty? He goes, so they don't ask stupid, annoying questions. And I was just like, go.
That's brilliant.
I loved it.
That's really funny. Oh,
back to the old fare hopping, shall we say, the individual fare strike that we've all carried out on an individual basis. People got really mad at me when I tweeted about getting a ticket for fare evasion. I was like, oh, hey, I just got a ticket in the Morgan Avenue station. If you're there, watch out. There's cops hiding around the corner. People got so mad at me. They're like, pay the fare, Jamie.
What?
They made it all about me. And I was like, okay, nerds. First of all, it's not about me. It's about warning other people. Second of all, public transit should be free.
Agreed.
It's a human right, the freedom of movement.
Third
I'm not going to apologize
for
that.
Jamie at the Morgan Street stop. Wait, did people actually really get a-
I got like ratioed.
Are you serious?
Can we find this tweet and let's bring it back to life? Let's fight that off.
And let me just say this. If you ratioed Jamie for warning people about cops being at the Morgan Street shop, stop. Shame on you. You ought to be ashamed
of
yourself.
Get off Twitter.
That is so, that is the most like, pay your fair.
Maybe they're not from New York. I feel like some people are outside of New York don't really understand the criminal justice issues related to this, the fact that like they keep raising the fares and the service just gets worse. I mean, I went home the other night. This was, the signs don't even match. Like now they have these signs and they're like, to get on the N train, you have to go to the bottom platform. I'm like, number one, there is no bottom platform. Number two, like, where am I going? I don't know how to get home. Can you imagine being a tourist in this
number
city?
Number two, where am I going?
I don't know. I appreciate all the flat screens they're installing that occasionally show like a timetable, but for like 90% of the time you look at them, it's just an advertisement for something.
Yeah, exactly.
And holograms. My station was shut down for 2 years, which was great. They opened it up. Subway still doesn't work. Still not running normal times. But we have like freakish holograms at the Astoria at the 30th Avenue stop. It's not a real hologram. It's just like this virtual.
Is it Wolf Blitzer?
It is. They're doing the debate live from the subway station.
Oh my God. It's like live from the subway station. The same healthcare question again.
this conversation.
How do we pay for it?
Yeah, how do we pay for it? From the subway's question. Wait, Matt, what do you want to show us real quick?
Well, this is an all-time tweet by Majority Report producer Dorsey Shaw. Retweeted Liz Phair asking, what are these three new super tall, super skinny billions in NYC? And Dorsey responds, they're giant filing cabinets used for money laundering.
Basically.
Almost literally true.
That's absolutely perfect.
I thought she lived in Chicago. I guess she moved.
Who is Liz Phair?
Since Exile in Guyville. Oh my God.
Who is she?
Legendary, great musician from the 90s. And she's still around, but she had a very iconic album called Exile in Guyville.
I really like her account. It's Fizz Lair, not Liz Phair. That's very funny.
Why did people complain at you?
I don't know, but to answer everybody's questions, you work at the Majority Report, don't you make enough money? No, I don't. I work part-time at the Majority Report, and I spend the rest of my time doing organizing work that I don't get paid for, and working on my podcast, which I love very much, but doesn't make me that much money yet, so.
They think, I mean, I get this too, like, even if, you know, there's a Google, you Google your name, and it's like, you know, salary, legs, whatever they do to women.
Feet, legs.
But
feet.
I found this website. It's disgusting.
Jesus
Especially
Christ.
If you go on Fox News, there's like a whole leg section. There's an account that zooms in on your legs and there's a montage. I got into Google alert one day. I was like, okay, I don't know what to do with this, but
the foot people are comrades though. Remember when they proved that nude wasn't a AOC because the Wiki Feet people are like, the feet don't match. We've studied her feet extensively.
Not even close.
Yeah. I've been looking at Puerto Rican women's feet online for decades. Let me tell you.
It is a thing, though. I'll get, like, tagged. Google alert of my foot. They went through my Instagram from, like, 15 years ago.
Yeah. I just know it from doing this job when I used to, like, have to look up Fox and Friends clips on YouTube.
There's
somebody
Instagram.
Who just goes through Fox and Friends, and for any time, like women have legs out, they just clip that part. It's weird.
And there's music. It's
Jesus
creepy.
Christ.
I don't know how we got here. Oh, in terms of pay, because they also will say you make $5 million a year.
Maybe
not on
able,
YouTube, people.
Maybe I should monetize the foot pics somehow.
But number one, you could make $5 million a year and still be warning your fellow citizens.
Right.
I mean, you guys, that's just such a like. Why do you want to be a snitch?
Are you sure those weren't libertarians?
They might have been.
Yeah.
No, I got into it with some of them because
they're the type
I can't
of people
help
who
myself,
are like, why are you criticizing Pete Buttigieg?
Yeah, the most galaxy brain take that I saw from this was that I am a Marxist and yet I feel entitled to the fruits of other people's labor for free. And they're talking about like the people who work at the MTA.
To be fair, Brendan was drunk when he wrote that.
Big buddy.
Yeah, Brendan was just like, she feels she got a right to conduct his work. It's bullshit.
Oh, man.
She's going to some friggin' I'm a Goth Maoist party. Meanwhile, she's stealing from the conductor.
That is not how it works, folks.
I like Brendan's new alter ego. Let's play some. So let's play a little bit of sound, then we'll go to the fun half. Let's just do these pair of AOC and Ilhan Omar reaffirming why they've endorsed Bernie Sanders. So when is he going to? Do you know when he's going to Detroit with Rashida?
I think. Isn't it this weekend?
Is it this weekend? Yeah.
I don't want to say that and like screw it up.
I'm pretty sure. Because it's been like actually officially put out on her social media accounts.
I mean, it's not hard to figure this out.
The same research skills that led you to look up Nomiki's feet on her Instagram could be used to discover an endorsement date.
Bernie.
So 5 mil a year, huh? I had no idea.
Yeah, neither did I.
Jesus.
Amazing. Well, they are. I mean, the funeral is taking place, and I saw them at the funeral, and that doesn't mean they can't jump on a plane, but.
Wait for Elijah Cummings,
yeah.
Oh, did we miss the clip? I should have asked about this. There's a hysterical clip. I don't know who the gentleman is. We have it? Of the guy skipping McConnell? All right, yeah, we'll get to that later. All right, here is AOC. And ooh, they don't like to hear this on MSNBC. Uh-uh. Ooh, this is painful. Oh, how dare she be committed to her political commitments. Ooh.
These endorsements are part of the work that we have to do in the House. Very frequently, someone will say, oh, we can't pass a Green New Deal. We don't have support for that. Oh, Medicare for All is, quote unquote, unfeasible because we may not have support in certain areas of the House. Well, if we want to change that, then we need to be changing the math of the House. And we need to be protecting those folks who are leading and are taking political risks in order to serve the people of the United States of America. And so my work, first and foremost, informs the other work that I do to organize the electorate. But it is important to acknowledge that in order to pass a transformative agenda for working class Americans, we got to have the numbers and we got to have the leadership in place. And so we have to play in both if we're really going to change this country and if we're serious about that.
Absolutely. And here is Ilhan Omar. She was at, this is the Progressive Caucus Action Fund. And, you know, there's also a clip, which I guess we didn't pull with Mehdi Hassan, where she really made this point very strongly as well. And she actually even acknowledged her own gut check when he told her that she was basically singing a little bit of a different tune a year ago. This is Ilhan Omar.
I believe that Senator Bernie Sanders has complete fluency in the struggles of working people. He has been someone who has fought alongside and for marginalized people in this country for many years. And I believe that he and I share value and a vision for the America that we all deserve, and will do everything that we can to build the movement that will get us there.
Now, Miki, what do you think about these endorsements?
I think they're, they came at a perfect moment when the press was really trying to shove it down our throats that there was no electoral path for Senator Sanders, which is abundantly, you know, false. It's just, I mean, the polls are all over the place. They're right. Not, it's not, you know, one day like Pete Buttigieg is winning Iowa, which makes absolutely no sense. So it came at a really good moment. I mean, at the end of the day, they're going to need folks to turn out in states like Iowa, New Hampshire. And I believe that it's pretty tight. I don't think there's a big margin there. I think they oversample older voters. All the polls pretty much oversample older voters. And some of them are a little bit more skewed. He needs the young voters, new voters to register. And I think that these endorsements from the squad are motivating to young people, and hopefully there'll be surrogates that can run around the country and, not just campaign in their districts, but other districts, encouraging young people to register to vote, encouraging young people to get active however they can and tell their friends and families. Of course, tell your parents. That's, I think, key.
Tell your parents.
Have a talk with your parents. I saw somebody push this out on Instagram. Have an intervention about Biden. Even an intervention about other candidates, too.
Tell them you're not coming home for Thanksgiving unless they vote for Bernie.
Oh, my parents would be happy about that.
They're like, great.
They're like, wait, what?
Finally get a little bit of breathing room.
Exactly.
Jesus Christ. What are we going to hear about? The Greek sovereign debt crisis again? I can eat some friggin' cranberry sauce.
Real story.
Guess what?
I had to like interview with my family. We had a conversation yesterday. Can I mention this?
Yes, yes, you can.
So my grandfather passed away recently, and
sorry.
Thank you. He was in his 90s. The last of my grandparents used to live with me. I didn't know that there was a memorial because I was not shared on an email list. Yeah, so you think, okay, so you're like, oh, that's pretty effed up. Except the reason I was not on that email list is because many of the members of that list are Republicans. Some are born-again Christians who also believe that Obama was a Muslim. And so when that whole thing was happening, I was very vocal about Obama not being a Muslim and other, you know, conflicting stories that would be
and doing like the whole
yeah, but there's do, anything like,
the
wrong
double
with
step,
that.
Right? The
right.
double step.
Of
it's
course.
A lie, and it's not a problem. I'm picturing like a bunch of like I go to my own ultra stereotypes. So like, yeah. It's like some guy owns like a Greek diner, being like, no, you don't understand, no, Mickey.
I saw it on the internet. They got it in email
chains. And you are walking
chains.
Around talking about feminize. Meanwhile, you want to live in Obama's Saudi Arabia. She's crazy.
Right.
Take her off of the email list.
So they took me off. And so I miss all these important things like my grandfather's memorial.
I just want to say we didn't pull this because we didn't want to talk about the same subject again. But John King played those same clips of AOC and Ilhan on CNN and ran some footage of fly girls from In Living Color in the background.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm kidding.
I don't know. I really can't.
Yeah, he was the guy who said that, hey, these are urban.
I remember.
They're urban.
Tweeted
doesn't
that
matter.
One out. And his fake apology.
Yeah, I remember that. Like, don't take me out of context.
It's not.
That was the best. He's like, don't even try it.
I'm surprised it wasn't.
There is
pushback.
No way you're going to get me on that one. Anyways.
And it worked.
We're going to talk to Amy Klobuchar soon about a non-urban electorate.
Staplers and all the things she throws at her rural staff.
There's a lot more room for them to run. Okay, we're going to do plugs and then we're going to go to the fun half. But no, Miki, there's a new project you're working on.
Oh, yeah. Let's
talk
do this.
About it.
I was told by someone following me that I have to hide my headphones. Okay. someone texted me that they're watching. Is this better, audience? My headphones have been hidden.
Wow. Everyone's a critic.
I know. I got an alert on that.
An alert?
Yeah, just hide your headphones.
Jesus Christ.
Not from my family, actually. So yeah, very, very, very exciting.
It was the school in Indonesia. Anyways, cover your headphones.
Cover your headphones. This is really exciting. So I'm part of this coalition of women who many have run for office in the past. Some are in office. Some have lost office or you know, have run and not succeeded. And then we have activists and labor leaders and policy leaders and organizers and artists. But we're all progressive women. And we've come together to start a new organization called Matriarch. And it's a group that is supporting working class progressive women across the country running for Congress, starting with Congress. And the goal of the group is to fill a space because we think that economic justice and intersectional issues are not prioritized when supporting women running for office. But also, if you're a working woman running for office, you most likely don't have access to wealth. You don't have wealth. It's very hard to raise the money so that other institutional organizations take you seriously. So we want to help really from the ground level a lot of these candidates, help recruit candidates to run who have labor backgrounds, who are connected to their communities. But we also think that more women, I mean, we see what the squad did clearly in just, you know, a year, but more women who come from, you know, these backgrounds, from who are working class, who face real obstacles, who are in the front lines of every injustice, that they can run on those issues, they connect to their communities more, they're more electable, and of course, they're more courageous once they enter Congress. And so if we want to get to parity, if we want to prioritize, you know, women's related issues and more, we have to start talking about economic justice, criminal justice, climate justice, labor rights. I mean, these are the issues that have been fought for and led by many women, often on the front lines early on, but they're also on the front lines, especially women of color, especially, you know, immigrant women, undocumented women. They're really being hit first. And so we're seeking candidates. We just launched like minutes ago. So go to matriarchpack.com. If you want to throw in a few bucks, that helps, because we're trying to raise money to help these candidates early on and help them in other ways, too. So there's a lot of infrastructure support we're going to do that, you know, it's not just that it's hard to run for office when you're working class. It's hard when you're taking on the establishment because they'll often throw other things at you. So we're really excited. Very, very excited. Wow. And I just tweeted it out, too. Matriarch, I think the Twitter is at matriarch.org, so follow them.
So it's like Emily's List if they were actually good.
That's it.
That's a great interpretation.
Emily's List, not good. There's a lot of problems there.
Matriarch.
This is my comment, not yours.
Matriarch organization. We want to get this to blow up. We're taking nominations. So if you have if you know someone who should be running for Congress, there's still some time. We'd love to consider them. And then after the new year, we're going to release our endorsement list. And it's just an awesome group of people. So share, tweet, throw some bucks at us, because we got to get these candidates some early money, ground support money. Thank you for the plug.
Awesome. Check out the, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this whole thing happens. That's why we're here today. That's why Sam is able to sleep off a hangover right now or potentially still be arguing with somebody at the blackjack tables about the yield curve on Social Security.
Living the dream.
Living the dream. Do you see? Check out MajorityReport.fm. Also go to JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. On the Michael Brooks Show this past Tuesday, we had on John Iadarola and Artesia Balthrop. This coming Tuesday, jam-packed show. Crystal Ball. Harvey K is going to be in studio. And then I'm just about to record an interview with Kashama Sawant after this. I'd like, in general, if people can, to support her. She's an incredibly important politician. She's done amazing and courageous work on the Seattle City Council. She's one of these through lines.
Totally.
Whether we're talking about the Chicago teacher strikes, so on. She helped open the door to where we are at now. I'm very eager to interview her, but I'm in this case, you know, it's very action oriented. I want to see what we can do to help secure her reelection to the city council. She's extremely important. That's all on Tuesday. Patrons already have the full interview I just did with Adolph Reed Jr. The man is a genius. I was incredibly humbled by how much time he gave me. Talked about the managerial class, essentialism, and neoliberalism, touching on everything from the 60s through the 90s to South Africa to get where we needed to go. Adolph Reed is amazing. That interview is for patrons first. And next week, my interview with Slavoj Žižek will be for patrons first. That was a lot of fun. Patreon.com/TMBS. Get the whole thing. Subscribe on YouTube. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. We're about to be at 84,000 subs. Want to get to that 100,000. And very close to our first 3,000 patrons. So thank you. And also snag your tickets. November 23rd, World Cafe, Philadelphia, live show. Artesia Balthrop, Emma Viglin, Crystal Ball. It's going to be so good, folks. Very exciting. It's going to be really good.
How do you pick the cities?
That's a good question. We just, I don't know. Me and my agent just talk about it.
It's nice.
Honestly, a lot of it is patron lobbying.
He's listening.
I listen. I'm listening.
He's connected. He's connected to the folks. You're just like a modern day Bill O'Reilly. Yeah, it's going really, around doing the live events.
Yeah, exactly. Then me and Miller are going to Philly.
Yes, exactly.
Meet at World Cafe.
Although he's like a socialist now too. I don't know what's going on with Bill
what
O'Reilly.
Was that? Wasn't he like tweeting out like favorable stuff? Or it wasn't like favorable. It was just like, sort of like, so if I understand correctly, Bernie's saying the whole system doesn't work. We need to change capitalism.
Yeah, Bernie wants a Green New Deal because capitalism is destroying the world, is what he tweeted out. But I think he meant
he probably
it in
thought
like
it
scare
was
quotes.
A dunk.
I think he left out some square quotes.
He left out some square
this
some
but
square
unironically,
quotes.
As the kids say.
Yeah, this but actually. Jamie, what's up?
So I've got a few things going on. October is a very busy month for us goth socialists. So this week in the free episode of the Antifada, we have not one, but two guests First, we have on Shyam Khanna, editor of Commune Mag, to give us a little preview in what's in issue number 4, as well as a breakdown of Saturday's Bernie Sanders rally from an ultra-left wrecker perspective. Joshua Strawn, half of the dark wave duo Azure Swan, then joins us. We all talk about what the kids are listening to these days. We make some music recommendations, and we talk about the new Azure Swan record and why Billy Joel has better politics than Nick Cave. That one kind of broke my heart as someone who always liked Nick Cave. Today, Friday, we have a very, very, very...
That's really true.
What?
I don't want to step on the show, but that's fascinating. Billy Joel better than Nick Cave?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Billy Joel
said a Cuomo supporter.
Said some real,
yeah, I was going to say, Billy Joel's Cuomo
He said
guy.
Some pretty Antifa stuff in an interview about,
maybe
punks
he's
walking around with swastikas. How come you don't beat them with a baseball bat? Nick Cave kind of both sides did a little. He kind of equated the far left and the far right in a way that a lot of goth socialists out there did not appreciate. But I also wasn't that surprised because he's just like this gloomy, poetic preacher man who travels around and sings sad songs, so I don't know what I was expecting from him. But anyway.
It's kind of like Bill O'Reilly.
No.
No, but Billy Joel is just like Bill O'Reilly. It's a very similar from the same area of Long Island. Originally.
Well, Billy Joel had family that died in concentration camps, so he understands fascism a little bit better, I guess.
This is a real debate happening on the left. There was a party after the Bernie rally in the neighborhood, and we got into some debates over whether or not like violence against Nazis is okay. And I'm just going to leave it at
fine.
World War II. I don't know. I mean, like, I it just doesn't seem like
it's fine. I don't know why this is even a debate that anybody is having.
Even the Pod Save America guys cheered when Richard Spencer got punched. So I think the debate's not.
I should tell you something.
Also, I mean, yeah, Maxime Bernier lost. So
he lost bad,
you know, on an anti-Antifa ticket. Right.
Just always think tactically.
But
that's
okay.
My answer to everything.
I feel like I should finish
that's about right.
the plug real
no,
quick.
No, we're not going to. We're just going to keep talking over you.
Finish the plug.
It's okay.
Well,
I'm totally used to it. So today we have a very exciting, I'm excited about it. I haven't even listened to it yet. Episode number 5 of History as a Weapon with Sean KB and Matt Chrisman. And each of these is a two-parter because they're just that monstrously good. Matt and Sean are diving into the historical materialist trenches once again. On this episode, they address suburbia and its discontents. Mm. How has the unique social geography of the United States affected its political and economic development? How are class relations reflected in the built environment? Why did the suburbs arise as a unique solution to social crisis in the post-war era? And what sort of mentalities and ideologies arose out of these milieu? I'm very, very excited about this one, folks. And tonight, if anyone's in town and wants to go to a really fun Halloween party and show and benefit, I am throwing a benefit show at Transpicos in Brooklyn, Queens. It's kind of on the borderline. We've got Azure Swan playing, really good dark wave band. It is their record release show. And Pop 1280, they're freaks. They sound like the birthday party. Canal Street Electronics is Mike Burdan from the awesome noise punk band Uniform. We've got DJs. We've got Comrade Barbie making an appearance once again. Comrade Barbie's a very good comrade, doing a drag performance. And we will be raising money for a really cool mutual aid center in Tijuana called El Comedor, and Contra Viento y Marea is the project it comes out of. It's run totally along autonomous principles. There are no NGOs involved. There's no state involved. They help migrants stay alive while the state is basically trying to murder them. And we ran some interviews with people from there in a recent episode of the Antifada. So I wanted to do something for them. So come out. It'll be fun.
Awesome. Wait, what time?
Doors open at 8. Bands start around 9, 9:30.
Tonight?
Yeah. Dancing till late in the night. If you're looking for something super goth and spooky and Halloween-y to do, come on out, wear a costume. Or if every day is Halloween for you, that's cool too. Come as you are.
Matt, luck.
Tomorrow, hopefully, it's going to be a marathon recording session, but I'll be talking about the Salem Witch Trials in a historical context and how it was basically the Puritans had their charter revoked by England because they were oppressing Quakers too much in the 1680s. And they're like, oh, please give us back. We'll be on our best behavior. But while that was going on, they killed a bunch of innocent people, accusing them of being witches. And the Mathers
go
like,
easy on the Quakers. Oh, this brought put a curse on me.
Yeah, the Mathers were like,
Tau Square trial.
We need to clean. We need to.
Yo,
spin
I
this.
Like that Tony Soprano Puritan. It's so stupid.
Yeah. So directly after Cotton Mather wrote a book about how actually the evidence they used wasn't so bad, and witches are real, and we.
Well, I believe. Yeah.
And mistakes
are real.
Were made though, so you yeah. know. What?
Oh, shit.
Look, not everyone that we kill was an actual witch, but there was one that took my fucking toenail clipping.
Actually, witches were often accused of going after like farm implements and property. That was a big.
This
if your
question.
Cows died, you'd blame the local like woman who was annoying you, or like maybe
right.
poor.
There is without a material explanation for this.
Well, was it also even more like not to step on this either, but it is interesting. Like annoying social position, class position, sure, but like was it also correlated with like. Maybe a couple of women were meeting and talking about right. changing the way something was done, and then that got transposed. Was that sort of thing happening at all, too?
That definitely happened with, like, Anne Hutchinson a generation yeah. earlier, for instance. Like, she okay. was accused of being a witch because she was basically, like, more... basically, like, I don't want to get into antinomian controversy, but eventually, like, she had a...
None of us want to do that.
Yeah.
Certainly not.
Sorry,
yeah, I mean, please.
But she had miscarriages.
Indubitably.
And, well, like, yes. the bad thing is like, after she was, you know, speaking out about, you know, her religious views, she had a miscarriage, and they said, yeah, see, she's possessed by the devil.
No, so, she had the evil eye.
The evil eye?
That's what my family would say.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
She has the evil that. Eye. That's why she loves
what
Obama.
What does that mean? Who has
we must get her in... off. We have to get her off of the email
what
list, or we will all be cursed.
I don't
generic
know what
generic Mediterranean salesperson
sounds
accent.
Sounds just like yeah. a Mediterranean accent.
Oh, whatever.
I'm just kidding.
The evil eye is the thing kid, I've been cultivating in myself for years in an effort to get people to just leave me alone.
That's fine. You just have a blue, you can just get, yeah, you
check
got
it out.
You're good,
I
you're
got
safe.
Two of them on me, I got one on my ankle at
yeah,
all times.
You're safe.
It takes, well, hopefully, it's you're taking an energy, it can be good or bad energy, but just the action of taking an energy from other people depletes your energy,
ugh,
can cause sickness, headaches,
truth.
Migraines,
word.
Yep, dementia.
Definitely, yes. Absolutely.
You know, yep. And then there's this thing in Greek, I mean, it's a lot of Mediterranean countries, where you...
Yes, many Mediterranean.
You have someone in your family who can do the thing to get the evil eye off of you, but you can't know when they're doing it. They just need to know where you are. And my uncle does that in our family.
Well, let me just add, thank you, Nomiki.
It's important information.
All right, we'll see you in the fun half.
That wasn't the fun half?
No, we're already.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library,
What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way!
Unbelievable.
This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.